Ivan Lemitovich, Golovko said, as he approached the American president.
Sergei Nikolaevich, Ryan said in quiet reply.
What will Beijing think of this? The chief of the Russian intelligence service asked.
With luck, we'll know in 24 hours, Ryan answered, knowing that this ceremony had gone out on CNN's live global feed, and positive that it was being watched in China.
I expect the language will be profane.
They've said nasty things about me lately, Jack assured him.
That you should have carnal relations with your mother, no doubt.
Actually, that I should have oral sex with her, the president confirmed distastefully.
I suppose everybody says things like that in private.
In person, it can get a man shot.
Ryan grunted grim semi-amusement.
Bet your ass, Sergei.
Will this work? Golovko asked.
I was going to ask you that. You're closer to them than we are.
I do not know, the Russian said, with a tiny sip of his vodka glass.
And if it does not?
In that case, you have some new allies.
And what of the precise wording of Articles 5 and 6 of the treaty?
Sergei, you may tell your president that the United States will regard an attack on any part of the territory of the Russian Federation as operative under the North Atlantic Treaty. On that, Sergei Nikolaevich, you have the word and the commitment of the United States of America, swordsman told his Russian acquaintance.
Jack, if I may address you in this way, I have told my president more than once that you are a man of honor and a man of your word.
The relief on his face was obvious.
Sergei, from you those words are flattering.
It's simple, really. It's your land, and a nation like ours cannot just stand by and watch a robbery of this scale taking place. It corrupts the foundations of international peace. It's our job to remake the world into a peaceful place. There's been enough war.
I fear there will be another, Golovko said, with characteristic honesty.
Then together your country and mine will make it the very last.
Plato said, only the dead have seen the end of war.
So are we to be bound by the words of a Greek who lived 25 centuries ago?
I prefer the words of a Jew who lived 5 centuries later.
It's time, Sergei. It's fucking time, Ryan said forcefully.
I hope you're right. You Americans are always so madly optimistic.
There's a reason for that.
Oh, what would that be? The Russian asked.
Jack fixed his eyes on his Russian colleague. In my country, all things are possible. They will be in your country, too, if you just allow it. Embrace democracy, Sergei. Embrace freedom. Americans are not genetically different from the rest of the world. We're mongrels. We have the blood of every country on earth in our veins. The only thing different between us and the rest of the world is our constitution. Just a set of rules.
That's all, Sergei, but it has served us well.
You've been studying us for how long?
Since I joined the KGB, over 35 years.
And what have you learned of America and how it works? Ryan asked.
Obviously not enough, Golovko answered honestly. The spirit of your country has always puzzled me.
Because it's too simple. You were looking for complexity. We allow people to pursue their dreams, and when the dreams succeed, we reward them. Others see that happen and chase after their own dreams.
But the class issues?
What class issues? Sergei, not everybody goes to Harvard. I didn't, remember. My father was a cop. I was the first guy in my family to finish college. Look how I turned out. Sergei, we do not have class distinctions in America. You can be what you choose to be if you are willing to work at it. You can succeed or you can fail.
Luck helps, Ryan admitted, but it comes down to work.
All Americans have stars in their eyes, the chairman of the SVR observed tersely.
The better to see the heavens, Ryan responded.
Perhaps.
just so they don't come crashing down on us.
So, what does this mean for us? Xu Kunpiao asked, in an entirely neutral voice.
Zhang Hansan and his premier had been watching the CNN feed in the latter's private office, complete with simultaneous translation through headphones now discarded. The senior minister without portfolio made a dismissive wave of the hand.
I've read the North Atlantic Treaty, he said. It does not apply to us at all. Articles 5 and 6 limit its military application to events in Europe and North America only.
All right, it includes Turkey and, as originally written, Algeria, which was part of France in 1949. For incidents at sea, it applies only to the Atlantic Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea, and then only north of the Tropic of Cancer. Otherwise, the NATO countries would have been compelled to join in the Korean War and Vietnam on the American side. Those things did not happen because the treaty did not apply outside its defined area.
Nor does it apply to us.
Treaty documents have discrete language and discrete application, he reminded his party chief. They are not open-ended.
I am concerned even so, Xu responded.
Hostilities are not activities to be undertaken lightly, Zhang admitted. But the real danger to us is economic collapse and the resulting social chaos. That, comrade, could bring down our entire social order, and that is something we cannot risk. But when we succeed in seizing the oil and gold, we need not worry about such things. With our own abundant oil supply, we will not face an energy crisis, and with gold we can buy anything we require from the rest of the world.
My friend, you must understand the West. They worship money, and they base their economies on oil. With those two things, they must do business with us. Why did America intervene in the Kuwait affair? Oil. Why did Britain, France, and all the other nations join in? Oil. He who has oil is their friend. We shall have oil.
It is that simple, Zhang concluded.
You are very confident.
The minister nodded.
Yes, Xu, I am, because I have studied the West for many years. The way they think is actually very predictable. The purpose of this treaty might be to frighten us, I suppose, but it is at most a paper tiger. Even if they wished to provide military assistance to Russia, they do not have the ability to do so. And I do not believe that they have that wish. They cannot know our plans, because if they did, they would have pressed their advantage over us in terms of currency reserves at the trade talks.
But they did not, did they? Zhang asked.
Is there no way they could know?
It is most unlikely. Comrade Tan has no hint of foreign espionage in our country at anything approaching a high level, and his sources in Washington and elsewhere have not caught a sniff of such information being available to them.
Then why did they just broaden NATO? Xu demanded.
Is it not obvious? Russia is becoming rich with oil and gold, and the capitalist states wish to partake in the Russians' good fortune.
That is what they said in the press, isn't it?
It is fully in keeping with the capitalist ethos, mutual greed.
Who can say perhaps in 5 years they will invite us into NATO for the same reason? Zhang observed with an ironic leer.
You are confident that our plans have not been compromised?
As we come to a higher alert level and begin moving troops, we may expect some reaction from the Russians.
But the rest of them?
Bah!
Tan and Marshal Luo are confident as well.
Very well, Xu said, not entirely persuaded, but agreeing even so.
It was morning in Washington. Vice President Jackson was de facto boss of the crisis management team, a place assured by his previous job, Director of Operations, J3, for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. One nice thing about the White House was the good security, made better still by bringing people in via helicopter and car,
and by the fact that the Joint Chiefs could teleconference in from their meeting room, the tank, over a secure fiber-optic link.
"Well?" Jackson asked, looking at the large television on the wall of the Situation Room.
"Mancuso has his people at work in Hawaii. The Navy can give the Chinese a bad time, and the Air Force can move a lot of assets to Russia if need be," said Army General Mickey Moore, chairman of the Joint Chiefs. "It's the land side of the equation that has me worried. We could theoretically move one heavy division, first armored, from Germany east, along with some attachments. And maybe NATO will join in with some additional stuff. But the Russian army is in miserable shape at the moment, especially in the Far East. And there's also the additional problem that China has 12 CSS-4 intercontinental ballistic missiles. We figure 8 or more of them are aimed at us."
"Tell me more," Tomcat ordered.
"They're Titan II clones."
"Hell," Moore went on, "I just found out the background earlier today. They were designed by a Caltech-educated Air Force colonel of Chinese ethnicity who defected over there in the 1950s. Some bonehead trumped up some security charges against him. Turned out they were all bullshit, would you believe? And he bugged out with a few suitcases worth of technical information right out of JPL, where he was working at the time. So the Chi-Coms built what were virtually copies of the old Martin Marietta missile, and, like I said, we figure 8 of them are aimed back at us."
"Warheads?"
5 megaton is our best guess. City busters. The birds are bitches to maintain, just like ours were. We figure they're kept defueled most of the time, and they probably need 2 to 4 hours to bring them up to launch readiness. That's the good news. The bad news is that they upgraded the protection on the silos over the last decade, probably as a result of what we did in the Iraq bombing campaign and also the B-2 strikes into Japan on their SS-19 clones. The current estimate is that the covers are 15 feet of rebarred concrete plus 3 feet of armor-class steel. We don't have a conventional bomb that'll penetrate that."
"Why not?"
Jackson demanded in considerable surprise.
"Because the GBU-29 we cobbled together to take out that deep bunker in Baghdad was designed to hang on the F-111. It's the wrong dimensions for the B-2's bomb bay, and the 111s are all at the boneyard in Arizona. So we have the bombs, okay, but nothing to deliver them with. Best option to take those silos out would be air-launched cruise missiles with W-80 warheads, assuming the President will authorize a nuclear strike on them."
"What warning will we have that the Chinese have prepared the missiles for launch?"
"Not much," Moore admitted. "The new silo configuration pretty well prevents that. The silo covers are massive beasts. We figure they plan to blow them off with explosives like we used to do."
"Do we have nuke-tipped cruise missiles?"
"No, the President has to authorize that. The birds and the warheads are co-located at Whiteman Air Force Base along with the B-2s. It would take a day or so to mate them up. I'd recommend that the President authorize that if this Chinese situation goes any farther," Moore concluded.
"And the best way to deliver nuclear-tipped cruise missiles off Navy submarines or carrier-based strike aircraft was impossible because the Navy had been completely stripped of its nuclear weapons inventory, and fixing that would not be especially easy, Jackson knew. The fallout of the nuclear explosion in Denver, which had brought the world to the brink of a full-scale nuclear exchange, had caused Russia and America to take a deep breath and then to eliminate all of their ballistic launchers. Both sides still had nuclear weapons, of course. For America, they were mostly B-61 and 83 gravity bombs and W-80 thermonuclear warheads that could be affixed to cruise missiles. Both systems could be delivered with a high degree of confidence and accuracy and stealth. The V-2A bomber was invisible to radar and hard enough to spot visually unless you were right next to it. And the cruise missile smoked in so low that they merged not merely with ground clutter but with highway traffic as well. But they lacked the speed of ballistic weapons. That was the trouble with the fearsome weapons, but that was also their advantage. 25 minutes from turning the enable launch key to impact, even less for the sea-launched sort,
which usually flew shorter distances. But those were all gone, except for the ones kept for ABM tests, and those had been modified to make them difficult to fit with warheads.
Well, we just try to keep this one conventional. How many nuclear weapons could we deliver if we had to?
First strike with the B-2s? Moore asked.
Oh, 80 or so.
If you figure 2 per target, enough to turn every major city in the PRC into a parking lot.
It would kill upwards of 100 million people, the chairman added.
He didn't have to say that he had no particular desire to do that. Even the most bloodthirsty soldiers were repelled by the idea of killing civilians in such numbers. And those who made 4-star rank got there by being thoughtful, not psychotic.
Well, if we let them know that, they ought to think hard about pissing us off that big, Jackson decided.
They ought to be that rational, I suppose, Mickey Moore agreed. Who wants to be the ruler of a parking lot?
But the problem with that, he didn't add, was that people who started wars of aggression were never completely rational.
How do we go about calling up reserves? Bondarenko asked. Theoretically, almost every Russian male citizen was liable to such a call-up, because most of them had served in their country's military at one time or another. It was a tradition that dated back to the Tsars, when the Russian army had been likened to a steamroller because of its enormous mass. The practical problem today, however, was that the state didn't know where they all lived. The state required that the veterans of uniformed service tell the army when they moved from one residence to another. But the men in question, since until recently they'd needed the state's permission to move anywhere, assumed that the state knew where they were and rarely bothered. And the country's vast and cumbersome bureaucracy was too elephantine to follow up on such things. As a result, neither Russia, nor the Soviet Union before it, had done much to test its ability to call up trained soldiers who'd left their uniforms behind. There were whole reserve divisions that had the most modern of equipment, but it had never been moved after being rolled into their warehouses, and was attended only by cadres of active-duty mechanics who actually spent the time to maintain it, turning over the engines in accordance with written schedules which they followed as mindlessly as the orders that had been drafted and printed. And so the general commanding the Far East Military Theater had access to thousands of tanks and guns for which he had no soldiers, along with mountains of shells and virtual lakes of diesel fuel. The word camouflage, meaning a trick to be played or a ruse, is French in origin. It really ought to be Russian, however, because Russians were the world's experts at this military art. The storage sites for the real tanks that formed the backbone of Bondarenko's theoretical army were so skillfully hidden that only his own staff knew where they were. A good fraction of the sites had even evaded American spy satellites that had searched for years for the locations. Even the roads leading to the storage sites were painted with deceptive colors, or planted with false conifer trees. This was all one more lesson of World War II, when the Soviet army had totally befuddled the Germans so often that one wondered why the Wehrmacht even bothered employing intelligence officers. They had been snookered so frequently.
"We are getting orders out now," Colonel Aliyev replied. "With luck, half of them ought to find people who've worn the uniform. We could do better if we made a public announcement."
"No," Bondarenko replied. "We can't let them know we are getting ready."
"What about the officer corps?"
"For the reserve formations?"
"Well, we have an ample supply of lieutenants and captains, just no privates or NCOs for them to command. I suppose if we need to, we can field a complete regiment or so of junior officers driving tanks," Aliyev observed dryly.
"Well, such a regiment ought to be fairly proficient," the general observed with what passed for light humor.
"How fast to make the call-up happen?"
"The letters are already addressed and stamped. They should all be delivered in 3 days.
Mail them at once."
"See to it yourself, Andrei," Bondarenko ordered.
"By your command, Comrade General." Then he paused. "What do you make of this NATO business?"
"If it brings us help, then I am for it. I'd love to have American aircraft at my command," I remember what they did to Iraq. There are a lot of bridges I'd like to see dropped into the rivers they span.
And their land forces?
Do not underestimate them. I've seen how they train, and I've driven some of their equipment. It's excellent, and their men know how to make use of it. One company of American tanks, competently led and supported, can hold off a whole regiment. Remember what they did to the Army of the United Islamic Republic. Two active duty regiments and a brigade of territorials crushed two heavy corps as if it were a sand table exercise. That's why I want to upgrade our training. Our men are as good as theirs, Andrei Petrovich, but their training is the best I have ever seen. Couple that to their equipment, and there you have their advantage.
And their commanders?
Good, but no better than ours. Shit, they copy our doctrine time and again. I've challenged them on this face to face, and they freely admit that they admire our operational thinking. But they make better use of our doctrine than we do, because they train their men better.
And they train better because they have more money to spend.
There you have it. They don't have tank commanders painting rocks around the motor pool as we do, Bondarenko noted sourly.
He'd just begun to change that, but just begun was a long way from mission accomplished.
Get the call-up letters out, and remember we must keep this quiet. Go, I have to talk to Moscow.
Yes, Comrade General.
The G3 made his departure.
Well, ain't that something, Major General Diggs commented after watching the TV show.
Makes you wonder what NATO is for, Colonel Masterman agreed.
Duke, I grew up expecting to see T-72 tanks rolling through the Fulda Gap like cockroaches on a Bronx apartment floor.
Hell, now they're our friends?
He had to shake his head in disbelief.
I've met a few of their senior people, like that Bondarenko guy running the Far East Theater. He's pretty smart, serious, professional. Visited me at Fort Irwin. Caught on real fast. Really hit it off with Al Ham and the Black Horse. Our kind of soldier.
Well, sir, I guess he really is now, eh?
That's when the phone rang. Diggs lifted it.
General Diggs.
Okay, put him through.
Morning, sir.
Just fine, thanks, and...
Yes?
What's that?
This is serious, I presume.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir, we're ready as hell.
Very well, sir, bye.
He set the phone back down.
Duke, good thing you're sitting down.
What gives?
That was SACUR. We got alert orders to be ready to entrain and move east.
East where? The divisional operations officer asked, surprised.
An unscheduled exercise in eastern Germany, maybe.
Maybe as far as Russia, the eastern part.
Siberia, maybe,
Diggs added in a voice that didn't entirely believe what it said.
What the hell?
NCA is concerned about a possible dust-up between the Russians and the Chinese. If it happens, we may have to go east to support Ivan.
What the hell?
Masterman observed yet again.
He's sending his J-2 down to brief us in on what he's got from Washington. Ought to be here in half an hour.
Who else?
Is this a NATO tasking?
He didn't say. Guess we'll have to wait and see.
For the moment, just you and the staff, the ADC, and the Brigade Sixes are in on the brief.
Yes, sir,
Masterman said. There being little else he could say. The Air Force sends a number of aircraft when the President travels. Among these were C-5B Galaxies. Known to the Navy as the Aluminum Cloud for its huge bulk, the transport is capable of carrying whole tanks in its cavernous interior. In this case, however, they carried VC-60 helicopters, larger than a tank in dimensions, but far lighter in weight. The VH-60 is a version of the Sikorsky Blackhawk troop carrier, somewhat cleaned up and appointed for VIP passengers. The pilot was Colonel Dan Malloy, a Marine with over 5,000 hours of stick time in rotary ring aircraft, whose radio call sign was Bear. Kathy Ryan knew him well. He usually flew her to Johns Hopkins in the morning in a twin to this aircraft.
There was a co-pilot, a lieutenant who looked impossibly young to be a professional aviator, and a crew chief, a Marine Staff Sergeant E6 who saw to it that everyone was properly strapped in, something that Kathy did better than Jack, who was not used to the different restraints in this aircraft. Aside from that, the Black Hawk flew superbly, not at all like the earthquake while sitting on a chandelier sensation usually associated with such contrivances. The flight took almost an hour, with the President listening in on the headset, ear protectors. Overhead, all aerial traffic was closed down, even commercial flights in and out of every commercial airport to which they came close. The Polish government was concerned with his safety. "There it is," Malloy said over the intercom. 11 o'clock. The aircraft banked left to give everyone a good look out the polycarbonate windows. Ryan felt a sudden sense of enforced sobriety come over him. There was a rudimentary railroad station building with two tracks, and another spur that ran off through the arch in yet another building. There were a few other structures, but mainly just concrete pads to show where there had been a large number of others, and Ryan's mind could see them from the black-and-white movies shot from aircraft, probably Russian ones, in World War II. They'd been oddly warehouse-like buildings, he remembered. But the wares stored in them had been human beings, though the people who'd built this place hadn't seen it that way. They had regarded them as vermin, insects or rats, something to be eliminated as efficiently and coldly as possible. That's when the chill hit. It was not a warm morning, the temperature in the upper 50s or so, Jack thought, but his skin felt colder than that number indicated. The chopper landed softly, and the sergeant got the door open, and the President stepped out onto the landing pad that had recently been laid for just this purpose. An official of the Polish government came up and shook his hand, introducing himself. But Ryan missed it all, suddenly a tourist in hell itself, or so it felt. The official, who would be serving as guide, led them to a car for the short drive closer to the facility. Jack slid in beside his wife.
"Jack," she whispered.
"Yeah," he acknowledged. "Yeah, babe, I know." And he spoke not another word, not even hearing the well-prepared commentary the Pole was giving him. "Arbeit macht frei," the wrought-iron arch read. "Work makes free," was the literal meaning, perhaps the most callously cynical motto ever crafted by the twisted minds of men calling themselves civilized. Finally, the car stopped, and they got out into the air again. And again the guide led them from place to place, telling them things they didn't hear but rather felt, because the very air seemed heavy with evil. The grass was wonderfully green, almost like a golf course from the spring rain. From the nutrients in the soil, Jack wondered. Lots of those. More than 2 million people had met death in this place. 2 million. Maybe 3. After a while, counting lost its meaning, and it became just a number, a figure on a ledger, written in by some accountant or other who'd long since stopped considering what the digits represented. He could see it in his mind, the human shapes, the bodies, the heads, but thankfully not the faces of the dead. He presently found himself walking along what the German guards had called Himmelstrasse, the road to heaven. But why had they called it that? Was it pure cynicism? Or did they really believe there was a God looking down on what they did? And if so, what had they thought he thought of this place and their activity? What kind of men could they have been? Women and children had been slaughtered immediately upon arrival here because they had little value as workers in the industrial facilities that I.G. Farben had built, so as to take the last measure of utility from the people sent here to die, to make a little profit from their last months. Not just Jews, of course. The Polish aristocracy and the Polish priesthood had been killed here. Gypsies, homosexuals, Jehovah's Witnesses, others deemed undesirable by Hitler's government. Just insects to be eliminated with Zyklon B gas, a derivative of pesticide research by the German chemical industries. Ryan had not expected this to be a pleasant side trip. What he'd anticipated was an educational experience, like visiting the battlefield at Antietam, for example. But this hadn't been a battlefield, and it didn't feel at all like one. What must it have been like for the men who'd liberated this place in 1944, Jack wondered. Even hardened soldiers, men who'd faced death every day for years, must have been taken aback by what they'd found here. For all its horrors, the battlefield remained a place of honor, where men tested men in the most fundamental way. It was cruel and final, of course, but there was the purity of fighting men contesting with other fighting men, using weapons. But that was rubbish, Jack thought. There was little nobility to be found in war, and far less in this place. On a battlefield, for whatever purpose and with whatever means, men fought against men, not women and kids. There was some honor to be had in the former, but not this. This was crime on a vast scale. And as evil as war was, at the human level it stopped short of what men called crime, the deliberate infliction of harm upon the innocent. How could men do such a thing? Germany was today, as it had been then, a Christian country, the same nation that had brought forth Martin Luther, Beethoven, and Thomas Mann. Did it all come down to their leader? Adolf Hitler, a nebbish of a man, born to a middle-grade civil servant, a failure at everything he'd tried, except demagoguery. He'd been a fucking genius at that. But why had Hitler hated anyone so much as to harness the industrial might of his nation not for conquest, which was bad enough, but for the base purpose of cold-blooded extermination? That, Jack knew, was one of history's most troublesome mysteries. Some said Hitler had hated the Jews because he'd seen one on the streets of Vienna and simply disliked him. Another expert in the field, a Jew himself, had posed the proposition that a Jewish prostitute had given the failed Austrian painter gonorrhea. But there was no documentary evidence upon which to base that. Yet another school of thought was more cynical still, saying that Hitler hadn't really cared about the Jews one way or another, but needed an enemy for people to hate, so that he could become leader of Germany, and had merely seized upon the Jews as a target of opportunity, just something against which to mobilize his nation. Ryan found this alternative unlikely, but the most offensive of all. For whatever reason, he'd taken the power his country had given him and turned it to this purpose. In doing so, Hitler had cursed his name for all time to come. But that was no consolation to the people whose remains fertilized the grass. Ryan's wife's boss at Johns Hopkins was a Jewish doc named Bernie Katz, a friend of many years. How many such men had died here? How many potential Jonas Salks? Maybe an Einstein or two? Or poets? Or actors? Or just ordinary workers who would have raised ordinary kids? And when Jack had sworn the oath of office mandated by the United States Constitution, he'd really sworn to protect such people as those, and maybe such people as these too, as a man, as an American, and as President of the United States. Did he not have a duty to prevent such things from ever happening again? He actually believed that the use of armed force could only be justified to protect American lives and vital American security interests. But was that all America was? What about the principles upon which his nation was founded? Did America only apply them to specific limited places and goals? What about the rest of the world? Were these not the graves of real people? John Patrick Ryan stood and looked around, his face as empty right now as his soul, trying to understand what had taken place here, and what he could, what he had to learn from this. He had immense power at his fingertips every day he lived in the White House. How to use it, how to apply it, what to fight against, more important, what to fight for. "Jack," Kathy said quietly, touching his hand, Yeah, I've seen enough, too. Let's get the hell away from this place. He turned to the Polish guide and thanked him for words he'd scarcely heard, and started walking back to where the car was. Once more they passed under the wrought-iron arch of a lie, doing what 2 or 3 million people had never done. If there were such a thing as ghosts, they'd spoken to him without words, but done it in one voice. Never again. And silently, Ryan agreed. Not while he lived. Not while America lived. This concludes the reading of The Bear and the Dragon by Tom Clancy, Part 2.